The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live on this September the 14th, 2022. I'm honored to talk to Dr. Paul Kennedy, professor at Yale, about this epic and magisterial new book, Victory at Sea. And I've linked it over at my Twitter account. You will be able to listen to the entire podcast, including when I go off the air later today at my podcast site, Salem Podcast Network, or iTunes or Spotify. Dr. Kennedy, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Good morning, sir. Nice to be on your show.
It's been a long time coming because I've always admired your work, and I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about Victory at Sea, which is, by the way, magisterial. Congratulations, you and Ian Marshall, who is the illustrator. You must be very proud of this work.
I'm very proud of it. There's a sad tale to it, as we mentioned as we get into the thing, which is Ian Marshall, this wonderful painter of American landscapes and Navy scapes and battleship scenes, passed away a few years ago, and I took over this venture and brought it to fruition, but it is, I'm so pleased, a testimony to him and his paintings, as well as the story of the war at sea. Thank you, Hugh.
Well, I have read a lot of World War II history. The Fleet at Full Tide, of course, Eagle Against the Sun. Everything is always updated, but this is, I think, the definitive history, Victory at Sea, and it's so beautifully illustrated. I want to begin with a very current question, though, Dr. Kennedy, and then I'm going to go through the book with you at some length. Given all you know about America's ability to ramp up, caught unawares in 1939 at Pearl Harbor, I think 1941 at Pearl Harbor, not a participant from 39 to 41, could the United States respond in this era as it did then by simply bringing eventually its massive productive power to bear in a Pacific conflict?
It couldn't do it immediately, that's for sure. So the word eventually may be the one that you put your finger on and gives room for hope. But, of course, our shipbuilding capacities now across the nation are nothing like they were in the latter stages of the 1930s and going up as we ramped up from the fall of France, 40 to 41. We have very substantial shipbuilding capacities on the East Coast to West Coast to Gulf. Now we are much, much more limited to one or two big shipyards which can build big ships, but nothing like anywhere like the surge capacity. That's the word we're looking for, the surge capacity of the American nation to double, treble its sea forces if it needed to in a crisis in the future. Nothing like it.
I want to underscore that because right now the United States Navy has about 280 surface combatants at sea. This comes from page 388 of Victory at Sea. The sheer size of the American naval armada surrounding Okinawa was a retelling of the story of the Pacific War. As 1,200 landing vessels commenced their Easter Sunday, April 1 assault on the central beaches of Okinawa, they were screened by 200 destroyers, 18 battleships, and over 40 carriers. That's bigger than the entire U.S. Navy today, Dr. Kennedy.
Yes. Now, the defenders of what's going on in the size and power of our fleet today would say, well, a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier of the Gerald Ford class or the now-retiring Nimitz class is so much more powerful than those carriers surrounding Okinawa in 1944. But we had so many more of them out there. And so one of the questions about our present power is the possible vulnerability of the limited number of warships, including limited number of aircraft carriers, which we have stretched across the globe today for our commitments from the Eastern Mediterranean through the Indian Ocean to the far Pacific, not to mention keeping an eye on Mr. Putin.
And we're going to come to Russia and Japan in the World War II and the similarities today. But I want to start at also the capacity of America in the 40s to absorb the tragic cost of war. I married into a naval family. I'm just a civilian, Dr. Kennedy, but the naval family is fairly famous. Taussig, my brother-in-law's father, died captaining the Twigs to a kamikaze off of Okinawa. The Taussigs go back to World War I and World War II. I've heard about this all my life, but I had no idea until I read your book that at the Battle of Okinawa, three escort carriers, 14 destroyers, among them the Twigs, were sunk by kamikazes, and that 4,900 sailors died, 4,800 were wounded. That was larger than the number of Army killed on the battle itself, 4,675 on land and 2,938 Marines. That's astonishing. I never knew that, and I thought I was well-read about the Navy.
The number of kamikazes which the Japanese Empire still had after the fall of the Philippines and Leyte Gulf, still had after Iwo Jima, was large and increasing. So our Picket destroyers in particular, those ones going out to try to identify where the oncoming flood of kamikazes are coming from, in which direction, and to take the early hits, they were going to be very badly hurt and in some ways decimated. In some way, the size of the losses could have been even greater. We took heavy hits at Okinawa, and I was surprised when I got to writing the chapter 10 on the year 1945, which I thought was just an easy cruise to victory after the great victories in the Pacific and around Leyte Gulf in 44. I was surprised at how hard and how difficult we found it to take the island of Iwo Jima and then Okinawa and then get ourselves prepared with some concern and anticipation for what might be the greatest invasion of all of Japan, which because of the coming of the atomic bomb just didn't happen. But the Navy was ready, as was the Army, to go in very large numbers and take even higher casualties.
That's what, Dr. Kennedy, I want people to read the entire book, but I especially want them to read, before they debate the atomic weapon, your description of the cordon around Japan. The United States had a choice. They could have made Japan starve. They could have done firebombing. Both of those would have resulted in horrific casualties among the Japanese and, of course, fleets of kamikazes headed towards our fleet. Here are the Okinawa death tolls that Dr. Kennedy puts in Victory at Sea, which I was unfamiliar with. 77,000 Japanese troops died on Okinawa, 110,000 if you add in the Okinawa conscripts. Another Teiken, another 10,000 died in the mopping up. 149,000 civilians died in Okinawa, and 12,000 U.S. servicemen were killed. Can you imagine? My father was in the flotilla off of Japan for the Southern Island first feint. I'm glad he didn't have to go aboard, or I would not be talking to you today, Dr. Kennedy. Can you imagine what the casualty counts would have been if Japan had to be invaded?
So the U.S. Army and the Department of Defense were doing some calculations, some estimates about what the potential total number of casualties would be in, say, the first 3 months or so of struggling onshore and then fighting their way through the mountains in lower Japan against fanatically organized resistance. And the numbers were not pretty. Some people thought that the numbers calculated were just far too large, that the Japanese would fall early after the first strikes on land. But they couldn't be sure about that. And it is true that if you talk to many old hands, there's not so many, of course, left by now, but when I first came to Yale in 1983 and I was talking about the war in the Pacific and listening to some of the old hands who were there on the ships, on the landing craft, just wondering about what their fate would be if there was a Japanese mainland invasion, they were the people so relieved about the dropping of the bomb. It may indeed have saved large further Japanese civilian casualties, because starving them out as the submarines administration wanted was not a grand idea. Firebombing them by Curtis LeMay, city by city, village by village, was not a good idea. So in a bittersweet, ironic way, for a large number of players in August 1945, the shock effect of the dropping of the two atomic bombs was a, I put in inverted commas for you and people listening, was a good thing. At least
yes.
So often discuss it.
That's at the end. I'm going to go back to the beginning of Victory at Sea, but I want people to understand how big those two invasions, the Southern Island and the Main Island. Operation Olympic, which was planned for November of 1945, would have required 670,000 troops, 11 Army Division, 3 Marine Division, and 24 battleships, 400-plus destroyers, 42 carriers to be met by kamikaze hordes. That's the first one. That's the feint. Operation Coronet for March of 1946, 5 million soldiers. I had no idea. 1 million Commonwealth soldiers from the United Kingdom and 4 million Americans. Those are staggering numbers. Dr. Paul Kennedy.
They're enormous. The only equivalent would be the size of the gigantic armies on the Eastern Front struggles of, the advance of a Red Army towards Germany in, say, 1944 to 45. Armies of millions of men. We have no equivalent in thinking about that in today's world.
Now, I want to go back to the very beginning of the book, and probably the greatest insight for us looking forward to the competition with China, which is underway on page 83. This is set in 1939 and then 41. The gigantic struggle for the United States that began with the attack on Pearl Harbor and ended with the dropping of the atomic bomb was different from any other major war in history, different in its dimensions and topography, different in the weapon systems and support systems, carrier power, landing craft, fleet trains, then emerged to be war-winning ones, different even in the sort of fighting units, the Marine Corps, the Seabees, that would have to be put together. It was geography that the country emerging victorious here would have to become a special sort of maritime power. The combatant that understood that first and better would be the victor. So everything had changed from World War II to 1941, Dr. Kennedy. Have they changed again from 1945 to 2022?
Yes, indeed. First of all, the basic strategic position that the United States is still, despite deficiencies, the powerhouse and the center of the Western military economic order remains. But it changes because of newer technology, which may be coming so fast that nowadays we don't really realize the dimensions of it are how we have to respond to it. It changes because we're probably not going to think again of a huge, huge American military reinforcement of 2 million plus men to the European theater and 3 million plus men to the Pacific theater. It may have gone up into the sky, to the ether, and yet we still need to be have the basic ship systems and weapon systems going across the Atlantic and the Pacific for this year of 2022 onwards into the middle of the century.
When we come back from break, Dr. Kennedy, we're going to talk about whether or not that's even possible in an era that saw food prices go up 13.5% year over year. I don't know what shipbuilding did, but it's going to be higher than 13.5%. I really don't know that we have the industrial base or the capacity to do what Dr. Kennedy so beautifully describes in this book, Victory at Sea. Because of inflation, if you're only going to buy one book for your dad, your uncle, your father, this is it, Victory at Sea. It's not only is it stunningly beautiful, it's wonderfully written. We come back, I'll continue talking with Dr. Kennedy about the challenge today and the challenge back then and their similarities. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Stay tuned.
Hey, everyone. This is Dwayne Patterson, producer of The Hugh Hewitt Show. I've known for a while now that there's been far too much of me here in the studio, and I finally needed to do something about my weight. My excuse was always that I couldn't follow a plan with the crazy schedule that I keep. I heard about PhD Weight Loss and Nutrition and how they customize their program for each client, and I decided to call. This was no problem for Rachel and the PhD team. They had me map out what my day looks like and created a plan to follow. And so far, I've lost 16 pounds already and I'm just 2 weeks in on the way to my goal of losing 45. Call PhD Weight Loss and Nutrition at 864-644-1900 and make your appointment for your consultation. The plan is simple. It's based on science and nutrition. There's no pills or injections, and they even include 80% of your food if you want it. Call them right now at 864-644-1900 or find them online at myphdweightloss.com. And tell them you heard about it from Dwayne, the producer Hugh actually has on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, talking with Dr. Paul Kennedy of Yale University. He is the author, of course, of The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, but his brand new book, Victory at Sea, is the book. Now, if you are like me and you love history, you've got a lot of books about World War II, you need this book, because it takes about 75 years to actually get a perspective, and then to have a great historian like Dr. Kennedy sum it up. So applicable to this day, September the 13th, September the 14th, 2022. Dr. Kennedy, on page 99 of Victory at Sea, you write, there's a need to qualify almost immediately any attempt at synthesis and generalization about the winning of the naval war. So I'm about to ask you three questions that require synthesis and generalization. And I know your humility about that, and it's throughout the book, and I appreciate it. But I need the audience to hear this in 2022, because we're losing the silent war right now with the People's Republic of China. Number one, defense production base matters. Do you agree or disagree with that, Dr. Kennedy?
Completely agree.
And how do you measure defense production base?
It would not only be the sort of production lines we could get moving right now if we wanted to, say, order another 20 or 30 fast carrier aircraft, if we wanted to order one or two additional destroyers for the Navy budget for next year, it would be what is our inherent surge capacity if we felt the need to try to double or treble our production of destroyers and frigates, or to double the production of the U.S. submarine force at the moment. And quite frankly, we don't have the yards there. We don't have sufficient of the trained, skilled riveters and electricians to do the job. Many of them are near retirement age. And the Navy must be actually worried. It would be a double-edged sword, so to speak, if they were told we could have the monetary resources to try to increase the fleet in a large way, or increase the size of the Air Force in a large way, because probably we couldn't do it.
I want to go to page 89, to my second vast overgeneralization. Your friend and mine, Admiral Stavridis, likes to say quantity has a quality all of its own. I am looking at the size of the world's merchant navies in 1939 by gross tonnage. The British Empire had 21 million tons. The United States had 9 million tons. The Axis powers combined had about 15 million tons. That decided the first two. We had the merchants to lose, in one sense of the word. Do you agree with Admiral Stav that quantity has a quality all of its own?
Yes. You might have quoted Stalin, Joseph Stalin, who said, victory goes to the great battalions. There's something to be said about the inherent long-term advantage of numbers. And this comes back, if we followed Admiral Stavridis' interesting search for trying to think about what the possibilities are of a future conflict in 2034, what happens when we run out of number of missiles or torpedoes we have, because the other side has just, frankly, rather more than we do. Numbers do count. And if you're talking about a large power in a large-scale war scenario, surely that counts even more than the small ones.
My third generalization, when the shooting starts, you go to war with the Navy you have, not the one that is out there at the end of a 20 or 30-year plan, or even a 10-year plan. It's a Rumsfeld applied to victory at sea. you go to war with the Navy you have, Dr.
Yes.
Kennedy.
The British Admiral at the beginning of the 20th century, John Fisher, said you cannot create an additional flotilla of battle cruisers just by a parliamentary estimate or congressional law. You have what you have at the beginning of a conflict, plus maybe the ships and the aircraft which are close to being produced and ready for fighting.
And my last on the air, we're going to continue the podcast and post this as we get deep into it. The battleship was not what we thought it was going to be. I don't know that the aircraft carrier is going to be what we think it was going to be in the next battle. What do you think, Dr. Kennedy? Is the aircraft carrier the battleship of 2022?
This is a really, really big question, Hugh. For historians looking back at the Second World War conflict and for our consideration and scratching our heads about a future conflict, what I'm talking about here is what historians and military analysts called asymmetric warfare. The age of the ever bigger super battleship in the first half of the 20th century was also an age of these asymmetric weapons. The torpedo, the aircraft, the submarine, maybe these smaller weapons of war could take out the giant one, as
that's
did
what
in such numbers.
That's what we're going to talk about on the podcast, America. It'll be available at the Salem Podcast Network, over at iTunes, at Spotify as well. Just Google Hugh Hewitt and iTunes and Highly Concentrated Hugh. Dr. Kennedy and I will continue talking after the break. We'll be back tomorrow with the latest from inside the Beltway. I'm going back to D.C. after the show. Stay tuned. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home, or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172. I am back with Dr. Paul Kennedy, author of this brand new bestseller, Victory at Sea. It's a little early for Christmas present shopping, but not really. Go to Amazon and get your copy before they're all gone. It will take a while to reprint. My gosh, it's a gorgeous book, Dr. Kennedy. And I appreciate, you know, it's so gorgeous. For the first time in my life, I've interviewed since 1990, probably 30,000 standalone interviews. And if any of them have been an author, I've marked in the book. You know, I make my end notes at the back of the book. I make my margin notes. I was taught that by Nixon. I won't touch your book because it's so beautiful. It's the first book I've taken notes contemporaneously on my iPad rather than mark up the book. That's how beautiful it is. Did you insist on that?
You know, I had a great deal of difficulty. I and my literary agent had a great deal of difficulty trying to sell the notion of this book of a book of the war at sea in the Second World War, but sort of impregnated, so to speak, with the wonderful paintings of a marine artist, Ian Marshall, because that would take a sophisticated job of laminating the pages to put that primer colors in. And also we wanted the paintings to be within the text, not just bound together in one group in the center of the book. And many of the big trade publishers walked away from that. So it took a leap of faith to turn to the current publisher, Yale University Press, well known for doing paintings of marine artists like Turner and Constable, and persuade them to take this and produce it as superbly and subtly and expensively, in the process at least, as they did with this book on Victory at Sea. Well, so the paintings run from side to side, top to front, as well as being there in the middle of the text itself.
And may I compliment on detail? I do not know who your cartographer was or who decided which graphs to include. Or I'm looking at page 186, the Japanese onslaught, December 41 to June 42. There in one half page diagram, color coded yellow and red, is the war summed up. And if you look at page 151, the German encroachment in the Atlantic, the Bismarck chase from 1941. It finally makes sense, even to a non-sailor like me. It just making the Pacific make sense is impossible, but the Atlantic ought to be easier. And finally, you did it. I don't know how long you labored over this. But congratulations.
We labored for years. There's one act of labor, which is, of course, simply to take and choose from, say, the 200 paintings that Ian Marshall had done before his death on warships at sea in the Second World War. The second act is to actually write and design the text of the book itself. But the third act was one which took us about a year and a half. And in an ironic way, Hugh, we were helped by COVID. Like many other publishing productions, we had to slow down. There was no use bringing this to the American public when, say, Barnes & Noble stores were closed. It gave us a chance to work with a wonderful cartographer, Mr. Wilson, who lives down in Maryland, and to give him ideas about how the various maps should be, the maps of the fighting campaigns should be done. It gave us a chance to go looking for statistical tables and arrange them in a particular way, like how many U-boats has the German Navy at sea every day of a war in one particular graph. And so we worked hard to make the illustrative materials of the maps and the charts and the statistical tables match up to the paintings of Ian Marshall himself.
Well, they did a magnificent job. I'm looking at on page 119, the Battle of Norway in April 1940. I don't know that I've ever seen it put into one page before, or how important it was to the victory at sea that eventually followed and to the setbacks that the Germans inflicted on the Brits in the first year of the war. But that is really quite remarkable. So I've told people about it. My second standard for a book is, do they tell you something you've never learned before? I just want to give you two examples. It happens on almost every chapter. Two things that I had never heard of: the Yamato. I did not know anything about the Yamato battleship being the largest kamikaze in history. Would you tell that story? It's a super dreadnought, and it's the biggest kamikaze of them all. It didn't work, but it's still kind of a stunning story not to know.
Right. So the Japanese admirals in the 1920s and early 1930s, looking at the strong possibility in their minds, at least, that they were going to have a great fight against the American Navy in the Pacific sometime in the coming decade, decided that they were going to build absolutely the biggest battleships of all time. The Yamato class of four very, very large vessels was to displace about 72,000 tons. That's about 20,000 tons more than the biggest American battleship. And it was to throw 18-inch shells 20 or 24 miles across the ocean. In fact, only two of those were brought to completion, and the Yamato itself was still there in the beleaguered Japanese Navy near the very end of the war. So the instruction was given to the captain of the Yamato to set off from the Japanese port southwards towards Okinawa, then in the middle of the great fight following the American invasion, and to go there in a one-way trip. This is something quite amazing, to go there and sort of beach itself near the landing operations and then to fire and destroy as much as possible before inevitably it would be taken out by the vast numbers of American carrier aircraft. This one-way journey does not get that far. The Yamato is detected. I tell this story, and it's a quite familiar one to naval historians. The Yamato is detected by a U.S. submarine shortly after it leaves harbor. It's tracked for a while, and then the U.S. carrier navy rushes forward to show the destructive power of hundreds of high-level bombers, low-level bombers, dive bombers, and torpedo bombers. And the Yamato collapses after a number of hours of multiple attacks.
And thank God that it did. Had it beached and turned those guns on the landing forces, it would have been incredibly destructive. But that's a story I just did not know. Let me mention the second one. I know about the Graf Spee battle. And I know about the courage of the British sailors undersized attacking them from two directions. I know that. But I never knew, number one, that there was an actual Admiral Graf von Spee, and he fought the World War I Battle of the Falklands until I read it on page 112. More importantly, I didn't know about the six battle groups and the hunt for the Grafsby and how meticulous, how it kind of telegraphed the future of all ocean war.
Graf-Hansbey was indeed a distinguished German sailor and commander of what was the German East Asia Fleet in 1914. He ran across the Pacific, pursued by Allied forces, British forces, was very successful in attacking British forces down in the southwest tip of Chile and Argentina, and then suffered the fate when he met overwhelming Royal Navy forces. The Grafsbey epic of 1939 was of a lone wolf, again in distant waters, and again brought to bay by Royal Navy ships. But the ships which damaged the Grafsbey, such that its commander decided later to scuttle, were nothing like, and this is your point in your question, nothing like the vast array of hunting groups which the British and at that stage the French Navy sent out in pursuit of this single raider. Aircraft carrier groups, battle cruiser groups, heavy cruiser groups going in different directions to try to pursue this lone wolf of the oceans.
It's an incredible story, and it's so compactly told by you. And I appreciate great storytelling. That's what I expected from Victory at Sea. Let me move to a couple of the strategic issues. You write, of course, about Pearl Harbor. Anyone would say that it is a tactically brilliant attack, strategically a disaster as it brought America into the war on the major scale, but strategically a disaster as well as they did not hit the submarines, a single carrier, or the oil facilities. I was reminded of 9/11, the tactical surprise achieved by Osama bin Laden in getting four missiles in the air, but the strategic mistake he made of hitting the wrong targets, not crippling the United States, bringing us full in the war. Now, some Islamists will argue that he made a strategic choice that has paid off. America's out of Afghanistan and withdrawn largely from the Middle East, but generally back to the Japanese choice. If they had it to do over again, what would they do with that first strike that they tactically surprised the United States with?
I think everybody's a latter-day strategic expert because you look at what the general, what the admiral could have done or might have done. Supposing that the Japanese forces had been organized for a second strike, supposing they'd taken sufficient supplies there, sufficient numbers of bombs and torpedoes and anything they needed, so that when their carrier aircraft returned to their six wonderful and rather nimble fleet carriers, at the end of the bombing of that first day of December the 7th, 1941, supposing they had come again and decided to attack these other targets, not the battleships and battleship row, they were pretty well finished off. Why not go for the submarine sheds? Why not go for the oil and the oil refining facilities there? Supposing Pearl Harbor, after two or three days of strike, had been just a burning ruins. How much longer would it have taken for us to start the recovery process of marching across the Pacific from 1942 to 45? Much, much longer. Maybe it was even possible to think of a third stage of a Japanese attack, which would be an invasion of the Hawaiian Islands. Many people say, well, that's much, much bigger. Would have taken many, many more men, hundreds of thousands of Japanese. But at the same time in December 1941, the Japanese were sending hundreds of thousands of men out to take Southeast Asia, Malaya, Singapore, the entire Indonesian archipelago. Maybe they should have pushed in this direction across the Central Pacific.
That is a great word of warning to the future. I also want to talk about 1942. Last night, as I was preparing, after I'd finished reading Victory at Sea and made my notes, I just went back and listened to the audio condensed versions I have of Churchill's War Member, The Hinge of Fate, and the next volume in the sequence, or The Grand Alliance, and then The Hinge of Fate. And it is about 1942. You referred to it as the year, the fighting most in all of naval history. But Allied sea power by the end of 42 had established that their foes would advance no further. The losses had been heavy and the fighting ferocious. But on page 198, they are cabined. The Japanese and the Germans can go no further. They can wreak havoc on us, and they did, but they are at their high water mark because we had scrambled from 41 to 42. Could we do that again today, Dr. Kennedy?
No, I think it would be take much longer, and we would have only limited resources with which to scramble. This is the difference between now and then. We were taken by surprise. We were not ready for the war when it came in 1939 in Europe and 1941 in the Pacific. But we had a breathing space of a year or two in which by 1943 to start moving significantly on the offensive. I wonder whether we would be allowed a two-year breathing space from the beginning of any major conflict in the Pacific or further afield. I doubt it.
I want to conclude by talking about First Lord of the Admiralty Dudley, of whom I have a great opinion and a very high opinion, but it is a caution to everyone in a position of authority. Convoy PQ-17 sets out from Iceland to Archangel, 34 merchant ships on page 204, and the First Sea Lord, maybe the worst decision he makes, orders them to scatter. At the end, only 11 make it, proving that even the most experienced admiral, after a year of war, 2 years of war, still doesn't have it down, Professor Kennedy. That's an astonishing bit of humility induced for all of us, right?
Yes. Dudley Pound had, of course, the great worry that the giant remaining German battleship, the Tirpitz, would come out and wreak havoc among the merchant ships, the defenseless merchant ships of convoy PQ-17. And so he made that fateful decision. I think if he had been one of the British admirals who had been in charge of sending time and again the Malta convoys through in 1942, they would have accepted the principle of keeping the convoy together, even though you are going to lose, say, in the great pedestal convoy of August 1942, even if you were going to lose like 9 out of 14 ships, it was better to hold them together and try to fight your way through than to scatter the merchant ships and have them picked off by submarines and by aircraft one by one. Mind you, we were all wise commentators after the event.
Dr. Kennedy, I want to conclude by, you're such a distinguished historian. You've written The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. Now you have put the definitive book on World War II at sea, Victory at Sea, in people's hands. Again, I urge everyone to go to Amazon.com and get it, buy a Christmas present early. What do you make of the state of the world right now, Dr. Kennedy, and where we're going to be 100 years hence? It's not armchair quarterbacking. It's the opposite. You're not a prophet nor the son of the prophet, but great historians often have great insights into what's going to happen next.
I would look at the state of the world right now and look at the variety of pundits who tell you about the China danger or what Putin's up to or the challenges to U.S. across the Middle East. Take them as the specialists can offer you the data and their advice, but try to put it all together. We have a troubled republic at home. We have one worried about American overstretch and overcommitment. We have a frizzled congressional fight coming up, and we have uncertainty about American leadership. All of that I have to take for granted and then turn around and say, across the globe, there are a significant number of challenges, possible large challenges to America and its allies in the years to come. Can we think in grand strategic terms? Can we order our priorities? Can we be nimble enough to think of creating armed forces which could be sent to one theater of conflict and contestation in 1 month and then relocated to another? Have we built up the reserve surge capacities by asking the Congress to invest not so much in frontline stuff, but maybe in a large amount of backline stuff? Because we have the assumption, I think, that whatever conflict comes in the future, Q, is going to be a very quick one, a very quick shoot it out in the South China Sea. Supposing you ask the question, which we sometimes do in our Naval and Maritime Studies little center here at Yale, What happens after the first year of fighting if there hasn't been a decisive victory one way or the other? This, after all, was what the British had to figure out after the first year of the war, fighting at sea from 1939 to 40 to 41. Are you ready for the long haul? Are you able to look left and right and to the south at the same time and have a number of trained commentators and military, naval, Air Force leaders who can do it? That's the big question for us now
it is.
For the future.
I also have to ask, do we have a Dönitz? And I hope I'm saying his name correctly. I admire him not because he's a fascist Nazi, of course, but because what a brilliant strategist. He took Germany's submarine force and almost made them decisive. In Victory at Sea, you talk about the three wars, the Mediterranean Naval War, the Atlantic Naval War, and the Pacific Naval War. But he's the figure that stands out to me as he almost won it all for Germany by starving Britain into submission. And I think it's going to be an under-the-sea war that we have to worry about, Dr. Kennedy. And I don't know that we have enough of those vehicles right now, vessels right now.
I'm rather happier with the state of the current U.S. submarine fleet. Let's leave to one side, although you might say, wow, that's an eye-popper to say leave to one side. Let's leave to one side the nuclear warhead, nuclear missile submarines, and talk about the fast attack submarines which we have. We're still somewhat ahead of the Chinese there, although they're building enormous numbers of them, whether smaller diesel engine ones or now the new nuclear-powered ones. If I had a limited amount of further dollars in which to put some money for the future flexible response possibilities of the U.S. Navy, I would put it, as you just suggested, in underwater assets and try, even if possible, to get a 20, 30, or 50% increase in the number of our attack submarines. That at least we could do.
Oh, you know, Dr. Kennedy, one of the guests I've had on is the fellow behind Barrett Maritime strategy to bring onto the Great Lakes submarine repair facilities, because we haven't got many. Some of our submarines stay a year and a half to 2 years in dry dock waiting for their repair cycle. That's the whole thing is put out in Victory at Sea. If you are not prepared to produce and then maintain your Navy, it's not a Navy.
So the story of a responsive U.S. naval shipbuilding, including yards which were set up in the Great Lakes to build submarines which were transported roller down across and then down the Mississippi, is one of the sort of nice little nuggets you can pick up in the story of the big response of the U.S. surge capacities after Pearl Harbor and for the next 2 years before the tide begins to turn in our favor, because we do have a longer-term productive capacity once we put the dollars in and the building capacities there to enhance and support our vast fleets across the oceans.
And my very last question, Dr. Kennedy, since you're such an eminent historian, if a young scholar is about to commence a career as a historian, what is your advice to them? Because increasingly we enforce specialization for tenure, but of course your reputation is built on being astonishingly broad in scope and penetrating in insight. What do you tell the young would-be historian looking at a 50 or a 60-year career in the stacks and at the computer?
The young historian, along with, say, the young political scientist, is encouraged increasingly to be narrow, to define a particular small area of research, to delve into it, and to produce after, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years, the dissertation which you hope is going to be accepted, and then maybe you get a job in this competitive academic world of ours. Maybe you get in at the bottom. I would encourage that person, even though it's tight at the time, even though you might have early, you know, family responsibilities as a 27-year-old PhD, to try to think of writing something in parallel to your dissertation, maybe something small, or maybe some sort of secondary area. Try to keep like one day of the week going for some other book project or some other line of writing continuously, so that you can have one or two things extra up your sleeve when the time comes for your tenured committee to look at how productive have you been. Try to do one book, your major book on your major areas of long-term research, but think if you can of doing some secondary project which will keep you distracted and may actually be a psychological benefit to you rather than concentrating narrow-mindedly on the single thing.
Boy, that is great advice. And the bonus question, Admiral Stavridis, we've mentioned he's such a prolific author. Dr. Jerry Hendricks, Navy captain, who wrote to provide and maintain the best sort of urgent missive to the Congress on how to expend money. Do you read history by non-professional historians? Because I sure do. I mean, Jerry Hendricks is a PhD in history, but I read Stav and I read Hendricks, even though they haven't been spending all their years inside of Yale or Harvard or Princeton. I read everybody. What do you do?
So do I. There's no reason for a professional historian to be so sniffy about the work of those who are not in the PhD producing field or not in the narrow corridors of academia. Sometimes those individuals have insight. Sometimes they have access to sources which we may not. In any case, they're usually better writers. Just this past week, I was asked by a chemistry professor pal of mine, what did I think of Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August and The Proud Tower? And I said that they're wonderfully written books, and it's useful, and it's an act of reminding yourself of perhaps you could write better and craft your book better and design it better if you took a leaf from the books of a great amateur historians, as we call them.
Amen. Lawrence Wright's The Looming Tower. Doris Kearns Goodwin, of course, a professional at the beginning, but when she wrote Team of Rivals, she had been out of academia for a long time. What a great positive note and encouragement. Dr. Paul Kennedy, congratulations again. Victory at Sea is just a magnificent book. What a capstone achievement, and I hope you keep on writing. I'm sure you will.
Thank you so much, Hugh. Thank you. It was great fun to talk with you.
Thank you. Honor was mine. Have a great afternoon, Dr. Kennedy.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.